So we start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we will be taking in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 104. This is called the Samagama Sutta, the discourse at the place called Samagama. And this sutta seems to have a certain affinity with the sutta that we took last week, or was it 2 weeks ago? Sutta number 103. They're both concerned with how to preserve unity and harmony in the Sangha, particularly as the Buddha is deep in old age and coming to the end of his lifespan. So he has to lay down certain guidelines, measures, regulations in order to ensure that conflicts and disputes don't divide the community, especially the monastic community, and so that the Dharma will last long in the world. Okay, so this sutta has a special, also there's a special event that took place as the to explain the origin of this sutta, as we'll see from the beginning, at the beginning. Okay, so the sutta takes place when the Buddha was living in a town named, or a village named Samagama, which was in his own native land, the Sakyan country. And the event that inspired the sutta was the passing away of the leader of the Jains, who's in the Buddha's text called Nigantha Nataputta, but who is known to his own followers as Mahavira, the great hero, or as the Jaina, the victor or the conqueror. Okay, and so shortly before the sutta takes place, the Nigantha Nataputta had just died at a town called Pava. And then the sutta tells us that shortly after his death, the Nigantas had divided and split into two, and they had taken to quarreling and brawling, and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It's very picturesque language. But this is the standard kind of description which is used whenever quarrels take place amongst any group. Even when quarrels take place in the Buddha Sangha, we find the same description is used. For example, in Sutta number 48, which is the discourse at Kosambi, when there was when the Buddhist monastic community living at the town or city of Kosambi had become divided. And so we read on page 419 that on that occasion the bhikkhus at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. So this is a standard description of a quarrel that takes place within any group of people. Okay, but then the text continues and it illustrates or elaborates on how the two divisions of the Jain community were arguing with each other. They were saying, each one was saying, you do not understand this Dhamma and discipline. Interestingly, it uses the two words which are distinctive of the Buddha's teaching. Dhamma, actually all the Indian schools call their teaching Dhamma. But here we have the word Vinaya also used. So perhaps it was the case that each school would also call its own code of discipline the Vinaya. So maybe that was not a term unique to Buddhism. Okay, so they would say, you don't understand this Dhamma and discipline. I, or my side, understands this Dhamma and discipline. How could you understand? Your way is wrong, my way is right. I'm consistent, you're inconsistent. What should have been said first, you said last. What should have been said last, you said first. What you had so carefully thought up has been turned inside out. Your claim has been disproven. You are refuted. Go and learn better, or disentangle yourself if you can. And so it said that it seemed as if there were nothing but slaughter among the Nigantha Nataputta's pupils. And then his white-robed lay disciples had become disgusted, dismayed, and disappointed with Nataputta's monastic pupils, as they were with his badly proclaimed and badly expounded Dhamma and discipline, which was unemancipating, not conducive to peace, expounded by one not fully enlightened, and which was now with its shrine broken. The shrine probably would have been Mahavira, Nigantha Nataputta himself, and left without a refuge. You know, when we read about this description of the conflict, quarrels, disputes taking place amongst the Jains, again, I have to make a disclaimer, I'm not a Jain agent in disguise who spent some 35 years, actually that was 40 years as a Buddhist monk, so that in my 40th year of monastic life I could come out and come to the defense of the Jains. But we do have to remember that this is a description coming from the Buddhists, and the Buddhists and the Jains were rival communities in the same part of India. You know, the northeast states, Magadha, Kosala, Kosambi. And I've looked at the Jain texts, which are very boring to read because they're mostly descriptions of the minutiae of ascetic observances. But I would imagine where they're describing what takes place in the Buddhist community after the passing away of the Buddha, I don't imagine that if they say anything about it, that they would be flattering, speaking about the great harmony and unity and concord that prevailed amongst the Buddhists after the passing away of the ascetic Gotama. Okay, anyway, after the passing away of Mahavira, and then this conflict breaks out in the Jain community. Then there's a novice by the name of Chunda, who is said to have been the younger, I think probably the youngest brother of Sariputta. So he had spent the rainy season at Pava, because Pava was also right in the heart of the area where the Buddhas had been circulating and promulgating their teaching. And so Chunda would have spent, according to the text, he had spent the rains retreat at Pava, And so he would have gotten the first-hand account of the passing away of Mahavira. And so after the rains retreat, then he probably comes back to comes to Samagama in order to, again, to meet with the Buddha. And so first he comes to Venerable Ananda, because Venerable Ananda, of course, is the Buddha's personal attendant. And so in order to present some news to the Buddha, it's like Ananda is like the secretary, so you don't go immediately into the boss's office, but first you have to pass through the secretary. And so Chunda comes to Ananda and pays homage to him and then reports to him what has taken place with the Jains. And then Ananda says to the novice Chunda that this is important news which should be told to the Buddha himself. And so they decide to go to the Buddha and to report it to him. And so the two of them go to the Buddha, and Ananda tells the Buddha everything that he's heard from the novice Chunda. And then Ananda makes a very important statement. He says, "When I heard this, the thought occurred to me, let no dispute arise in the Sangha when the Blessed One has gone, when the Blessed One has passed away. For such a dispute would be for the harm and unhappiness of many people, for the loss, harm, and suffering of the devas and the human beings. So if there's a dispute in the Sangha, a big quarrel, a conflict in the Sangha, it would be not only for the harm and loss of human beings, but also of the devas or deities. Because the deities, are there is a class of deities which are called the Dharma-protecting deities, who try to protect the Dhamma in the human world and to see that it will endure a long time. And the deities delight when there's harmony and concord amongst the Buddhists and the human world. And if there were to be a dispute, a conflict, a schism in the Sangha, then even the devas would become miserable and upset." Okay, so now the Buddha, when he hears this, he's going to emphasize what is important to ensure that the Dharma will last long in the world. So he says to Ananda, "These things that I have taught you on the basis of my own direct knowledge, that is, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four right kinds of striving, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, the Noble Eightfold Path. Do you see even two monks who are making different claims, different explanations, different interpretations of these things?" Okay, so these are the teachings that the Buddha is emphasizing as the basis for unity and harmony in the Sangha. And the Buddha here, he doesn't elaborate upon them, he just mentions the main headings. But I'm sure that there are people here who could help us to understand them. Aren't there? Four foundations of mindfulness. It's a little rusty. Who can help? Michael?
The body, the mind.
We have to get them in order, not only to get them correctly, but in the correct order.
I don't think so. body, mind, no, that's not the order. Feelings, body, feelings, mind, and the last one I don't know how to say. Mind consciousness or mind result?
Sometimes they translate as mental objects, but I don't think that's so good. It's very hard to translate. We just call it dhammas, mindfulness of dhammas. Okay, so the four foundations of mindfulness are the body, feelings, mind or states of mind, and phenomena, which are, I'm not going to go into an explanation, but just phenomena organized into certain groups for contemplation. The four right efforts. We have to give some others the turn. Come, come. You want to take it?
To any, I'm not sure if you can do it in the audience.
You take the microphone.
Any unwholesome states of mind that arise, you put to the side.
I have to get the right order.
Is the first one wrong?
It's a correct item, but it's not the first one.
Okay, any wholesome mind?
No, the wholesome never comes before the unwholesome.
Okay. Any unwholesome mindsets that has not yet arisen, you keep away.
Okay, so you prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. Okay. Second.
Any unwholesome states that have already arisen, forcefully.
Well, it doesn't have to be forcefully, but we use a certain key word that always occurs in the Buddhist texts. It starts with an A, followed by a B, followed by an A. Followed by an N. What? A, B, A, N. Abandon. So, unwholesome states that arise, one abandons them. Third.
Any wholesome states that has not yet arisen, you provoke?
Yeah.
Or you arouse?
Arouse, yes. To arouse unarisen, wholesome mental states. And then the fourth one?
Any unwholesome states that has...
Any what?
Any wholesome states that has not yet arisen. Any unwholesome states that has already arisen, we encourage.
Okay, let's say stabilize. So, wholesome states that have already arisen, one stabilizes, strengthens them, develops them, and fulfills them. Okay, so those are the four right efforts, the four bases for spiritual power. Well, we went through them 2 weeks ago, and come, come, please help me. You wrong?
And then we'll put it in the translate.
Okay.
No, you should be able to translate in your mind in English. Okay.
Qin is diligent.
Okay.
For effort.
For effort, energy, yeah.
For energy, right? Qin is the mind.
Yeah.
Si Wei, I guess, is contemplation.
Usually we render that as investigation.
Investigation.
Yeah. Okay, so the four bases for for a spiritual power are desire, this is the wholesome desire, then energy or vigor. Third is the mind, using the purity, concentration of the mind. And then investigation or inquiry. Okay, now the five spiritual faculties. Now you guys have to be preserving the Buddha's teachings, so you have to, without any quarrels or conflicts, you have to know these. Yeah.
Concentration.
Yeah.
Wisdom.
Okay, very good. So faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the five spiritual faculties, the five powers. Johnny, you...
It's the same, so I raise my hand, I can answer that.
Okay, so it's the power of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, the seven factors of enlightenment. Po Wei.
The enlightenment factor of mindfulness, of investigation of the Dharma, of energy, and then rapture, of tranquility, of samadhi, and of equanimity.
Okay, very good. Okay, mindfulness, then investigation of phenomena, of dhammas, energy, rapture or joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Seven. Then we have Eightfold Noble Path. What are the eight factors of the path in the correct order? Barbara, you want to try? No? Wow, you guys have... I know that Oswald, you know because you got it last 2 weeks ago. But we have to get some of the others. Vivian, you want to try? Eight factors. See you.
I can't try. Might get the order on. Samadhi, pick the right view. Samasanta, the right thoughts.
Okay.
Samavacha, right.
Okay.
Words. Sama Ajiva, right.
No. Okay, you had right speech, yeah.
Speech. Sama kamanta, right effort?
No, sama, you have the Pali right, but not the English.
Right, things you do?
What do we call the things you do? Simply, simple term.
Action. Like action. Samajic livelihood. Sati, right? Right effort,
right.
Sati, right mindfulness.
Yep.
Samadhi, right concentration.
Okay, right concentration. Okay, so you got it correctly. So it's right view, right thought or right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, next week there'll be a test. So really, these things you should all be able to just knock off 1, 2, 3. You write them all down on a sheet of paper and memorize them.
In how many languages do we need?
Excuse me?
In how many languages do we need to know?
I think it's enough to know Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, and English. But if you just know in English, it'll be enough. Okay, so this is what the Buddha is emphasizing. The 7 groups, which come to be called the 37 Bodhipakkhiyadhammas, the 37 aids to enlightenment. Okay, so now Ananda says that I do not see even 2 monks who are making different claims about these things, but there are people who live deferential towards the Buddha, who might, after he is gone, create a dispute in the Sangha about livelihood, that's the way of life, and about the Patimokkha. And such a dispute would be for the harm and unhappiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and humans. Now this seems a little bit strange, but here the Buddha says a dispute about livelihood or about the Patimokkha would be trifling. He uses the word appamattako, Ananda. But should a dispute arise in the Sangha about the path or the way? The 2 words used here in Pali, Magga is the path and Patipada is the way, or Patipada also you could translate the practice. That dispute would be the harm and unhappiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and human beings. They say that when it said that the dispute about livelihood or about the Patimokkha is trifling, that seems strange, because elsewhere there's a passage where it's actually at the beginning of the Vinaya Pitaka, where Venerable Sariputta comes to the Buddha and he asks him, what is the reason why the sasana, the teaching of some Buddhas in the past, lasted a long time, but the teaching of other Buddhas was short-lived and came to an end soon after their passing away? And then the Buddha answers that the reason why the teaching of some Buddhas lasted a long time was because those Buddhas gave many teachings to their disciples, gave many discourses, and laid down the Patimokkha, the rules of discipline. Whereas some of the other Buddhas would just give teachings on the spot to their disciples, just according to circumstance. And so they didn't give very many elaborate teachings, and they didn't lay down the rules of discipline. And then in this passage, the Buddha compares the patimokkha, or code of discipline, to a thread, a string, which is used to hold flowers together. So if you have a string and you tie the flowers onto the string and you make a garland, then the flowers will stay together for a long time until they wither. But if you just have the flowers heaped up without the string to hold them together, then when the wind blows, the flowers get scattered. And so in this passage, the Buddha says that the code of discipline, the patimokkha, the training rules, that is like the thread that holds the flowers together. That is what preserves the teaching for a long time. And someone would think, certainly, that at least the primary rules would be, in fact, this is maybe the way to interpret this passage, is that the primary rules would be the ones that are essential for preserving the teaching. But there could be other rules, which the Buddha called kudakanu kutaka. These would be minor and secondary rules, that those would probably be, he probably foresaw that those could be subject to variation depending upon, you know, things like climate, geographical conditions, cultures of the people amongst whom Buddhism takes root, and so on. So I think this particular passage needs some interpretation to make it clear. But we shouldn't think when you see this that, okay, the Buddha said the disagreement about the patimokkha is trifling, therefore we just have to get rid of the patimokkha, and we just have the monks observing five precepts the same as lay people, and that will preserve the Dhamma for a long time. Okay, so now, after setting up this passage where the Buddha emphasizes what is the core or essence, now he's going to teach how disputes arise by taking disputes and conflicts, tracing them to their roots. And I think this passage shows what you might call the strong psychological orientation of the Buddha's own teaching. So for him, what's of primary importance are the mental qualities or mental states of the people in the community. So if we keep a watch on our own mental states, then even though there might be disagreements about aspects of the teaching, but through discussion and inquiry, investigation, then we can resolve those disagreements. But if the unwholesome mental states are what's motivating the dispute, then even the most trivial thing can become the basis for a dispute. Okay, so here the Buddha is now speaking about what's called the six roots of disputes. But actually, if you look at them, they actually turn out to be more than six, but a few of the qualities which are similar are grouped together into pairs. So he says, first, a monk is angry and resentful. So when a monk is angry and resentful, then he becomes disrespectful and undeferential towards the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and he does not fulfill the training. And then it's such a monk as that who creates a dispute in the Sangha, which would be for the harm and unhappiness of many, and so on. Okay, so first, you could see how systematically the Buddha is going to treat this. First, the Buddha points out what is the root of dispute, in this case, anger and resentment. then he shows the consequence that it leads to a dispute and it brings about the harm and unhappiness of many. And then he points out what to do about it. So if you see any such root of dispute, either in yourself, well, first in yourself, then you should strive to abandon that evil root of dispute in yourself. And then if you see that evil dispute, evil root of dispute externally, that is, if you see others who are in the grip of anger and resentment, then also you have to take action to eliminate it. Of course, you can't just do it through your own inner psychological effort, but if there's somebody else who's angry and resentful, then you have to speak to them and try to find out why they're angry and resentful and try to help them to overcome anger and resentment. In that way, you preserve the harmony of the group. Okay, but if you don't see any such root of dispute, either in yourself or externally, then you should practice in such a way that that evil root does not arise in the future. Thus there is the abandoning of that evil root of dispute, and there is no eruption of that evil root of dispute in the future. You see, so many aspects, just a very short statement, but so many aspects in oneself, externally, abandon it if you see it. If you don't see it, practice in such a way that it doesn't arise in the future. Okay, then the Buddha goes, so that's just the first root of dispute. The second is being contemptuous, that is sort of looking down at others and treating them arrogantly. And then its counterpart is being insolent, you know, insulting others, speaking about them in derogatory, denigrating ways. Then envy, you know, when others are successful or have good qualities, then one becomes envious of them. And because one doesn't like others to have good qualities, then sometimes one might smear them, malign them, speak bad about them to others, try to create discomfort for them. And then avarice, I think that's not such a good translation, better to translate miserliness. This is when one acquires things, then one doesn't want to share them with others. So, you know, there are some monks that get a lot of robes, and then they just store the robes, but even if they see that other monks don't have good robes, the robes are worn out, they're afraid to give one of their extra robes to others. Or if they have some good lay supporters, then they try to keep the lay supporters to themselves. They don't want to introduce them to other monks, afraid that the lay people will start to support other monks and then their support will drop off. Okay, so this is kinds of miserliness. And also the most important kind of miserliness that the Buddha mentions elsewhere, not here, is miserliness with the Dhamma. That is, a monk who has learned a lot of Dhamma doesn't want to share it with others because he likes to be well known as, you know, a learned, erudite monk, a great preacher, scholar. And so he doesn't want to teach others so that, because he's afraid that they will get a lot of knowledge and then they will shine. Okay, so this is miserliness. Then fraudulence, that is doing things which are wrong but trying to cover them up, conceal them. And deceitfulness, which means trying to display oneself, to show oneself as having virtues that one doesn't have. So, you know, a monk might not be, you know, very well developed, but when he comes into a group, particularly a group of like wealthy lay people, he'll come walking. Like he's mindful of every step. Then you makes it seem like he's pausing before sitting. Sits down. Ah, they're gone. Get out my cigars. Light up. Okay. Fraudulence, deceitfulness, evil wishes. These are, you know, wishing for fame, honor, reputation. And then wrong view, particularly the view that there are no consequences to good and bad deeds. That's considered to be the most pernicious of the wrong views. And then the last one, and this is a very serious cause of disputes within a group, and that is adhering to one's own views, holding on to them tenaciously, and relinquishing them with difficulty. You know, this is being stubbornly attached to one's own opinions and views. You know, often we have to undergo special training to be able to get rid of that kind of fault. Because it's just, it seems to be a natural tendency, you know, even within, well, maybe especially within monastic communities, people become learned and then they develop particular views and then they hold to those views very tenaciously and refuse to relinquish them. You know, like the view that space is an unconditioned dharma, or that there's such a thing as non-deliberative cessation. Okay, I think I've mentioned previously that when I first started to learn about Buddhism, at that time I was learning, I was in graduate school, this was before I became a monk, and I was living with a Vietnamese monk who had come to study in the same graduate school which I was attending. And I had just been reading about Buddhism, you know, for a few months. And then I went to learn Buddhism from him. And basically my reading in Buddhism was from Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki. These were the books that were available, and primarily available in the 1960s. 1967. And so whenever the monk who was my teacher would tell me something about Buddhism and it didn't agree with what I was reading in Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, then I would, you know, disagree with him and think he was getting it wrong. And I really would hold to those views very stubbornly and very insistently. I'd think, you know, this is what Alan Watts says. This is what D.T. Suzuki says. And he would be looking in, you know, these thick volumes. Since he was Vietnamese, like he was reading in the classical Chinese. And say, well, this is what the Diga Agama says. That this is what the Majjhima Agama says. But I would still say, they have it wrong. I'm right. But how to to overcome this, and it really used to cause so much trouble in my mind. And then, you know, I was also starting to practice meditation, so right after, whenever we would have these big fights, then I would sit down and try to meditate, and just the mind would be boiling over with these angry thoughts that I'm right, he's wrong, I'm right, he's wrong. My view is correct, that view is incorrect. So then one day, you know, when I was getting really upset, then my teacher called me and he said, what you should do now, every day you have to tell yourself, if I get into a dispute today, I have to remember, I might be right, I might be wrong. What's important is not that I should be right and the other person should be wrong, but that we should try to arrive at the truth. And so every day I would have to recite that to myself. And then it seemed to work a little bit. Okay, so the rest of the paragraph just repeats the same thing, you know, same method applies to each of these roots of dispute. Okay, before we go into the next section, maybe I should pause and ask whether there's any questions on anything covered so far or comments. Okay, now this gets a little technical, this section. But we'll go through it, maybe not in detail, but we'll see what is being brought forward here. So this is sort of where the sutta teaching is almost bordering or coming into vinaya or discipline type teachings. So here the Buddha says that there are these four kinds of, maybe the word litigation is difficult word to use, maybe not a fully appropriate word. Of course, litigation implies that people are going to court and suing one another and calling in lawyers. But these are types of grounds for collective action within the Sangha for settling particular cases that arise. Maybe you could say four kinds of cases that might arise that require special treatment. So what is the four? So there's litigation because of a dispute, litigation because of an accusation, litigation because of an offense, and litigation concerning proceedings or duties or activities that are to be carried out. The word here, the Pali word, is adhikarana. So the four kinds of cases that arise are, the word is adhikarana. From the word karana, it means action, and adhi, it gives it the sense of a basis for something that has to take place on top of that action. And then there's another word which goes, which is used in connection with these cases that arise. And this is the word samatha, which it's the same word that we use in relation to meditation when we speak about samatha meditation. But here it doesn't mean quieting down the mind and making the mind concentrated. But here samatha means bringing peace or settling the particular case that has arisen. So these are the samatha, are the means of settling these legal cases or disciplinary cases. And so from this you'll see that the Buddha was not only a masterful teacher in the sense of one who, you know, presented a doctrine and a method of practice, but he was also a very brilliant and very skillful organizer and administrator, one who knew how to bring a group together and to lay down guidelines to ensure that the group is properly regulated. And so, after mentioning the four types or four bases for litigation or four bases for settlement, then the Buddha mentions the seven kinds of settlement of litigation. So these are the seven adhikarana samatha, the seven means of settling these cases of litigation. And first he just enumerates them, and then we'll just go through the list and then see how they're applied. There is the removal of litigation by confrontation. Maybe confrontation, not a good word, we could say in the presence of. Removal of litigation by bringing into the presence of. Removal of litigation by means of memory. Removal of litigation on account of past insanity. The acknowledgement of an offense, the opinion of the majority, the pronouncement of bad character against someone, and then the seventh is called covering over with grass. Okay, so we have the first kind of case that can arise, the first basis for litigation, and that is a dispute. Okay, so here we have a case where the monks are disputing. One group is saying this is the Dhamma, another group is saying that's not the Dhamma, one group is saying this is discipline, the other group is saying that's not the correct discipline. And so there's a dispute, a conflict between these two parties. And so now the Buddha is going to explain how to settle this case by means of, here it's translated, confrontation, but better rendered by bringing into the presence of. So what the Buddha says is that here all of those monks who are in dispute should all meet together in concord. It doesn't mean that immediately the dispute is solved, resolved, but they're going to stop quarreling and sit down together, determined to resolve the dispute. So then when they have met together, what is called here now the guideline of the Dhamma should be drawn out. The word used is Dhamma Neti. Neti can mean, like one of the meanings is a thread or a rope. And so this is pulling out from the teaching, you might call the basic direction or the fundamental principles. And so one pulls out or draws out from the teaching the guideline. And then the text says, well, once the guideline of the Dhamma has been drawn out, that litigation, that dispute, should be settled in a way that accords with it. So this is the removal of litigation by bringing into the presence of. And the commentary says, you bring into the presence of because the monks who are disputing are coming into the presence of one another, and they're also coming into the presence of the Dhamma, trying to settle the dispute by examining the Dhamma. You know, it seems that there could still be differences in interpretation, so that the dispute, the settlement of the dispute is not guaranteed. But assuming that the monks want to live together peacefully and harmoniously, and that their purpose in becoming monks is not to win debates, but to practice in a way for liberation. So then when they meet together in concord, then they will investigate the teachings, perhaps bringing in a monk or some monks who are very learned and knowledgeable, and seeking their views of the teaching, asking them for advice, for guidance in how to interpret the teaching. Okay, so the second means of settling a dispute, we're still dealing with disputes, and this is the opinion of majority. So if the monks can't settle the dispute in their own dwelling place, if there's just a few monks, then they should go to another dwelling place where there's a greater number of monks. And then it said they should all meet together in harmony, and in the presence of the larger number of monks, then they should draw out the guideline of the Dhamma. Maybe within the original group of monks, there's nobody who's very learned, so they go to a larger community and they consult with a single monk or a committee of learned monks who could settle a dispute for them. Actually, the detailed explanation says that, you know, if they still can't settle it, then they have to abide, they have to, you know, find out what is the opinion of the majority and then abide by the view of the majority. And so in this way, there comes to be the settlement of this dispute by the opinion of the majority. Okay, so these are two ways of settling a dispute. In the original place, one draws out the guideline of the Dhamma and settles it, or else one goes to a place with a greater number of monks and then settles it there according to the opinion of the greatest number of monks. Okay, in section 16, now we're dealing with an accusation. This is how to settle an accusation where one monk or several monks accuse another monk of committing a very serious transgression. That is what's called a parajika. That's an offense which requires expulsion from the order, or one which is bordering on a parajika, one getting close to an expulsion offense. So in this case, one is asking the monk who is accused whether he remembers having committed such a grave offense. And he says, I do not remember having committed such an offense. And in this case, if that monk is regarded as a trustworthy monk, everybody respects him, and he's, you know, regarded highly within the community, not the kind of person that one would suspect of, you know, lying and promulgating a falsehood to justify his misconduct, then on the basis of his claim from memory, one accepts it, and then one dismisses the accusation based on his memory. The next case deals with what is called the removal of litigation on account of past insanity. And this is also a method which is used to settle a case of accusation where a monk has apparently committed a serious, a grave offense, and another monk is accusing him of that transgression. But in this case, the monk who was accused of the offense has actually committed that offense, but he had gone temporarily insane at the time that he committed that offense. And it's a principle in the Vinaya that if a monk is out of his mind or temporarily insane when he commits an offense, then he's not liable for the consequences of that offense. His action, his transgression, is not an offense because he was insane. Okay, so in this case, one monk is accusing another of committing a grave offense, one which requires expulsion or is bordering on expulsion. They ask him whether he remembers having committed that offense. He says, "I don't remember committing it," but despite the denial, then the accusing monk presses him further and says, "Surely you know quite well that you committed that offense." And then the monk who's being accused now says that I had gone mad, I had lost my mind. When I was mad, I said and did many things improper for a recluse. I don't remember, so I must have been mad when I did that. So in his case, the past insanity is declared for him. And in this way, the accusation is suspended and the monk is not liable for the offense. And so in this case, the accusation is settled by means of the claim of past insanity. Okay, now we come to paragraph, or section 18, and this is the method to be used when a monk commits a transgression and he remembers the transgression and he wants to clear himself of it. And this is a transgression not of the very grave kind, but of a kind which can be settled through confession to another monk. This is the usual way for clearing up offenses. There are two kinds of offenses which are grave offenses. One kind, if one commits that offense, one has to be expelled from the order. This is the four grave or expulsion offenses, engaging in sexual intercourse, stealing something of such value that one can be imprisoned or otherwise legally punished for it, murdering another human being, or making false claims to supernormal attainments. Then there are 13 offenses. If one commits them, one can't clear them simply by confession, but one has to confess in front of the whole Sangha, and then one has to undergo a series of penalties in the presence of the whole Sangha, and then one has to be reinstated again through an act of the whole Sangha. But any other offense can be cleared by confession to another monk. So that is the case being described here. So when a monk has committed an offense, then what he does is to reveal it and disclose it to another monk. So he goes to a senior monk, or if there's no one senior, he can even go to a junior monk. He arranges his robes and pays homage at his feet. And then in the presence of that monk, he confesses to the offense and makes a pledge to restrain himself in the future. And so in that way, the transgression is cleared up simply through confession. Okay, paragraph 19, and this is called the pronouncement of bad character against someone. And I'm not going to go through this in detail, but this is the procedure that's used when a monk is accused of a serious offense. He refuses to acknowledge it, but the other monks know that that monk has committed that offense. And so they keep on questioning him. The monk who's being accused keeps on answering evasively or denying his responsibility. And so they keep on pressing him and pressing him. He even claims that when he committed it, he was joking, raving, and so on. And so they will still levy that offense against him, and then they pronounce bad character against him because he's not admitting the offense. Okay, then finally we come to the seventh case, and this is the means, again, for resolving a conflict or a quarrel within the Sangha, where the Sangha has become divided into two factions, and they've been in a dispute, and finally they want to settle this dispute. But while they were disputing, they engaged in many types of activities, especially types of speech, which are considered unfitting for those who have gone forth, unfitting for monastics. And so if they're going to try to settle this dispute in detail and rehearse and review all of the different types of inappropriate behavior that one side engaged in against the other, then it will just drag on, and it will sort of spark up, and it'll like fan past resentments. And so what the two sides do is make an agreement to settle the conflict between them by, they use the metaphor of covering over with grass. I guess it's like ending a fire when the fire is sort of burning down and it's just in the stage of, you know, embers. Then one takes a heap of wet grass and puts it on top of the fire, and the wet grass makes the fire burn out. And so this is what is the way this is done. It said that when the monks have taken to quarreling and brawling and have deepened disputes, they may have said and done many things improper for an ascetic. So then the monks all meet in concord, and when they have met, then one wise bhikkhu on one side gets up, puts his palms together, and then he calls for a special act of the Sangha. He says, "Let the Sangha listen to me. When we were deep in disputes, we said many things that were improper for a recluse. And now, on the part of all of the monks on this side, I confess by covering over with grass any offenses of these venerable ones and any of my own offenses, except those which are serious transgressions and those which are connected with the laity." If it's connected with the laity, then the transgressing monks have to go to the lay people and apologize to them. Okay, and then a wise or a respected elder amongst the other group of monks on the other side of the conflict also gets up, and he makes the same confession on behalf of the monks on his side. So in this way, they restore harmony within the Sangha. Okay, before we just take the last part of the discourse, now I'll ask again whether there's any questions on this part, which is a bit technical. Richard? Yeah, you can take the microphone.
Am I to understand that paragraphs 14, 15, 18, and 20 are not concerning defeat for near defeat, right? And then 16, 17, and 19.
Wait, let me just track. Okay, 14, 15.
14 is on.
Okay, I see it. Okay, okay. 14, 15. Okay.
14, 15, 18, and 20 are the ones that don't say defeat or
right.
defeat.
Right.
And 16, 17, and 19 do.
Right.
So 16, 17, and 19 are for the bravest defenses.
Right.
That is the first of four sexual intercourse dealing or false name of supernormal power.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, and there are there also for the 13 other actions which are near to defeat? You said there were 13.
Yeah, yeah. There are 13 which require an act of the full Sangha.
Ah, okay. Is there a list of those?
Is there a list in the Majjhima Nikaya?
Of the 13 actions that require
a meeting of the Sangha?
Yeah.
The list is in the Patimokkha. It includes things like intentional emission of semen, with a lustful mind having contact with a woman, speaking lewd words to a woman, making a false accusation against another monk with the purpose, with the intention of trying to get him to drop out of the Sangha, several rules concerned with trying to foment quarrel or dispute within the Sangha, a schism in the Sangha.
Is there some place I'd like to read the set and discussion on them? Is some place I should look?
Let's see where you can find. If you can find a copy of the Patimokkha, you can just go. You find it in the word Patimokkha. I think it's on page 854. 854. I think there's probably some translation of the Patimokkha online.
Okay. All right. And my second question is, it's normal when he discusses a series of things to use the same order for them, but this time he doesn't. The seven type kinds of settlement, he lists in one order, and then he discusses them in the order of 1, 5, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know any reason for that? And it's also not the order of serious versus unserious either. That is, it's not the original order that he uses in paragraph 13, and it's also not the order of serious versus mild. You know why he would do that? That is on 13.
Yeah, my guess would be that he's following the sequence of the four things, more or less the four things mentioned in paragraph 12, starting with the dispute. So dispute applies to 14 and 15. Okay, then the second ground of litigation is an offense. So then offense enters in with 16. I'm sorry. The second one is an accusation. So then the accusation comes in with 16 and 17. Then an offense comes in with number 18. 19 seems a little bit out of place. It would seem to me that if it were following, you know, a more logical order, what's now paragraph 19 would precede paragraph 18. So it's keeping the sequence of things concerned with accusation. Then 18 is concerned with the third ground of litigation and offense. And then 20 again goes back to a dispute, but the procedure which is used, covering over with grass, seems to me to come to under the heading of litigation concerning proceedings. So I think if we look at it as following that the sequence of the four types of litigation, okay, Barbara?
Could you clarify for me what the meaning is when it talks about an offense involving defeat or bordering on defeat? What does that mean?
Yeah, the word defeat, the Pali word is parajika, which means that, as I said, if one a monk commits one of those transgressions, then it requires that he leave the monastic order.
Okay, or bordering.
And if bordering means it's getting close, but it doesn't go over. It doesn't quite go over the line. Okay, so now... Okay, please.
I have one question. Have you experienced this yourself in your life with any community?
Well, certainly I've seen... I mean, I've been participated in clearing offenses through confession. Procedures like this, I haven't been part of myself, because I've lived in just generally in small monastic communities where there's been fortunately a fairly high level of harmony and.
Well, that's good. I was just curious as how it impacted you and that and experience with it, how it worked out.
Yeah, no, I haven't had personal experience. Okay, so just coming into the last section of the sutta, okay, you could see now that, in a sense, everything which has come up to this point is all sort of originating or emerging from the problem of disputes and conflicts. So we have the teaching on the six roots of disputes, then the four kinds of litigation and the means of settling, which seem that it's introduced at that point because it's all centering around the problem of disputes. And now in the last section, the Buddha is teaching the six, what's called the six principles of cordiality, that is of friendliness and goodwill, which create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. So we just go through them very briefly. So this is that a monk performs bodily actions of metta, of loving kindness, both openly and in private, towards his fellow monks. That is, he can do it openly. For example, when there's a meeting of the Sangha, then they all maybe work together to, if they have to move things, to prepare the meeting room. Or if there is a sick monk, then bringing him things that he needs, medicine, food, and so on. So that would be done openly and privately or secretly. Maybe privately is just if there's one monk who's sick and needs some help, then one just helps them without making it part of a group activity. Okay, and then verbal acts of loving kindness, that's both openly and privately, you know, speaking well of the other monks, praising those who deserve praise, speaking gently without giving way to anger, and praising them both publicly and also, you know, speaking privately in a friendly, harmonious way to other monks. And though I'm speaking in terms of monks, we could apply these principles to any community. And then maintaining mental acts of loving kindness, that is, developing loving kindness in one's mind towards the other members of the community. Here we could see how a formula gets applied in a way where it doesn't quite work out maintaining mental acts of loving kindness both in public and in private. I don't know how one could maintain mental acts of loving kindness in public unless maybe if there's like a large meditation retreat and all of the monks are sitting together, then they're generating loving kindness to each other in the meditation hall. And then to do it privately when the monk goes off to his own room and sits in meditation, then he develops loving kindness towards the other monks in the monastery. Okay, so these three are just simply bodily acts, verbal acts or speech, and mental acts or thoughts of loving kindness. Then enjoying or using things in common with one's virtuous companions in the holy life. And so whatever gains one makes, that is, when one gets robes, alms food, little things that one needs, medicines, toothpaste, soap, towels, or even equipment, if one gets, you know, extra computer. No, I'm not joking. Or say one monk needs a computer, and there maybe can be several in a storeroom, so then they will give one to the monk who needs a computer. And so even if one goes on alms rounds and one monk comes back with a full bowl, another monk goes and comes back with just an almost empty bowl, and so the monk with the full bowl will put his extra food, usually they put it on in bowls or containers out on the table, then the monks who need can take from it until they have enough for themselves. So sharing things in common, then observing the precepts in harmony, so everybody is observing the same code of discipline. And then sixth, maintaining in common the view that is called noble and emancipating, and that leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So these are the six principles of harmony and respect. And then the Buddha ends by saying that, now he's addressing Ananda again, he says, if you undertake and maintain these six principles of cordiality, do you see any kind of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? And Ananda says, no. So if all of the monks are committed to these six principles of harmony and respect, then if there's any kind of bitter speech erupts within the Sangha, then they'll be able to settle that conflict which is starting just when it's in the bud. They'll nip it in the bud. And so therefore the Buddha says to Ananda, therefore undertake and maintain these six principles of cordiality, and then that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. And that is the end of the discourse. Okay, we'll break now for the lunchtime. And then if there's any further questions that you have in your minds, we come back after lunch, 10 after 12, quarter after 12, and we could discuss the questions then. Okay, so let us end now with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the Dhamma-protecting deities, with the fear spirits or Buddhas, and with all other beings, asking them to protect the Dhamma, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidika punyanta anumoditva chiram rakantu mang param. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati sedaya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati sedaya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Babagupadaya vichihitato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino. My mind has gone blank. Bhavagupadaya vijayate toe tantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuting. I don't know how opera singers can do it. Sometimes 2 hours opera and singing. My voice is going at, what, an hour and a half? Okay, so we'll come back at 12:15. Okay, we have to end. Okay, we end with the three bows.
Bow to bumping.